Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I walk a straight line, shackled and chained. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hillstring Gang, Rango the Three.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Bloody
Angola,
a podcast 142 years in the making.
The complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
And I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
And we're back, Woody Overton.
Back in the saddle,
baby. Back in effect.
Back in effect.
And we're bringing y'all a hell of a story today. Yes. Highly requested. Yes.
A legend.
Legend, someone you have some experience
with. I do. I have a lot of years experience with him. Solid dude. They can say whatever they want to. Anybody, you know, everybody's going to have their haters or whatever. And he marches to the beat of a different drummer, but he's a visionary and has affected so many lives.
Boy, he sure has. And I'll tell you, as far as research, I've probably enjoyed researching this man more than just about anyone I've researched.
Yeah, I read his book years ago when it came out. Of course, I have the family history at Angola and all that, and of course my personal history with him. Just super, super intelligent, super unique.
Yeah. Very. I think that's a great word to describe him, and of course. If you're hanging by a thread right now trying to figure out who we're talking about, it is the legendary warden of Angola, Burl Cain.
Burl Cain.
So we're going to start off and we're just going to kind of take you through a journey of his life.
Yeah, and I think it's so important this research that you put together. A lot of it I didn't know, especially about the early years. And I don't know how they haven't made a movie about him yet. Honestly, it's
got to be coming at some point.
So, y'all, this is going to be even more. We've done a couple of series before, but not real long ones or anything. But it's going to be several parts to this, but you got to stay tuned because every one of them is going to kick you.
Yeah. So, to start off, he was born in Pitkin, Louisiana. And I was not familiar with Pitkin.
Small town in Vernon Parish. Right.
Vernon Parish. And for those of you that are kind of wondering where Vernon Parish is, that's on the Texas line. It's kind of in the center of the state all the way to the westernmost.
Right. If you're familiar with Toledo Bend, the largest lake, and kind of splits Louisiana and Texas too, but fantastic for fishing and all that. It's real close to that. Kind of a piney woods area, but really, really rural.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, shit, there's not even any major highways to get over there. It's not from off the Interstate 49, which runs north and south, splits the state. It's probably an hour and a half, 2 hours from there.
Yeah, and he actually described it in an interview one time, and he said we didn't even have a stoplight.
Yeah, well, my hometown still doesn't have a stoplight.
So you think about that, folks. This is, you know, he went from that to warden of the largest maximum security prison in the United States, which, first of all, goes to show you that it doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter, you know, hard work. And right. and really destined. I think he was kind of touched by God to do right. what he does.
Right.
He's 80 years old as yep. as of today.
Yep. So he is a couple years younger than my dad. Born, my dad was actually maybe 1 year, because my dad was born the week before Pearl Harbor, and he was born on July 2nd, 1942.
It's still going. Born,
yeah, it's still going. Very, very yeah, healthy.
We're going to get into that.
But he grew up on a farm, y'all, and that's where he developed his work ethic. And let me tell you something. This dude can work.
Let me tell you, if you're 80 years old, look, if I make 80, I'm going to consider that a success, right? Yeah. So when you're 80 and you're still working, that tells you who he is as far as his work ethic is concerned. He grew up on a farm.
Right.
That would play a huge role in what, you know, his future development. And he grew up in a very religious household.
Right. And I mean, back then, it's not knocking it, but a lot of people, especially ones that were raised on farms, their parents had them to raise them as help.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they worked.
That's right. You needed help. You had another kid.
I'm talking about throwing hay, tending animals and cows and everything else, and working the gardens. And, hey, there wasn't any PlayStations and cable TV or anything. Hell, they're lucky that they had electricity.
And you woke up, you know, 4:30 in the morning to milk them cows and do all those things.
You didn't have a problem going to bed at dark because your ass was tired.
You were tired. Right. And his household was very religious, y'all. Extremely religious. He attended church, as he described it, every time the doors were open since birth.
Yeah.
And he didn't even dance. He wasn't allowed to dance or attend dances.
And I had a lot of people that I grew up with that were the same way, and that just wasn't acceptable. Yeah. So you want to talk about Bible Belt? That's one of the only, and I can't say Vernon is directly, but I know there's some parishes over there that are actually dry.
Yeah.
And, I mean, no, they don't sell alcohol.
Yeah.
They're Bible Belt. So we have down here, we're South Louisiana, where kind of everything goes. And then you hit that area of the state, and it's kind of a borderline to the west of Alexandria and all that. And they're really, really country. And then the further north you go, the more country you get. And there's a couple dry parishes in the state. And this area would have been one of them.
No doubt. And at his age, you know, being born in 42, he was kind of hitting those late teenage years when Elvis Presley was big.
Absolutely.
So I'd love to sit him down and ask him, how did you avoid not dancing when Elvis Presley came on the radio?
Didn't have a radio.
Yeah. That's it. That's probably exactly what he would say. I was out there milking cows. I wasn't worried about the king.
Right.
So also, Burl Cain never dreamed he would be a prison warden growing up. Of course, being from such a small town, that'd be like, you know, most people dreaming they were going to be an astronaut.
Right, right.
It just didn't seem possible. As a matter of fact, he remembers vividly fearing Angola, as it was common for his mother to tell him, you know, if you don't straighten up, you're going to end up in Angola. Yeah. It was a threat back then.
And one thing they did even back then, believe it or not, is most schools once a year sent their certain age group of kids, they bust them to Angola.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was educational for them, and then they, you know, they didn't hold back. They took you down the walks and stuff like that, and they fed you the prison food. And they were like, most of them, you know, the girls be crying and shit like that. And they're like, I ain't never coming to this motherfucker.
Yeah. It was used as a form of threat. And so he had another dream. And believe it or not, y'all, he wanted to be a veterinarian.
Yeah, wanted to be a vet. And when he graduated from high school, he went to LSU-Alexandria campus. Y'all, that's a satellite campus, and they have one in Alexandria and one in Shreveport to do just that. And but he struggled coming from a small town where the chemistry side of school, you know, basically was a fight for him, and they just didn't teach a whole lot beyond the basics, like the element charts and stuff like that at his high school. So he switched to something that was more prevalent in the areas for him, and that's agriculture education. And let me tell you something, vet school is tough. You might as well go and become a doctor.
Right.
And nowadays, you got to have a 4-point whatever just to get in, and there's no guarantee you're going to make it, and it's heavy, heavy on sciences.
You know, a lot of people don't realize LSU has probably the best vet school, if not one of the best in the country. The
nation, yeah, man. And the imagine this coming from probably, you know, my hometown. I graduated. We had 28 in my graduating class, right? Still didn't have a red light to this day.
Yeah.
This, I submit to you that his town was smaller. But there, and back then they didn't test for the kids to pass the test. You just got the books. You know, Jim.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a different type of education, and they were just giving you your basics. But the ag part, I mean, growing up on a farm, he already knew tons about it, right? And pretty much everyone in his family were teachers. So he settled on basically just working towards a life of teaching after college.
Yeah.
Which I think is very unique now that I know him, you know?
Right. Yeah. You look back on that life and you see how those skills,
right,
you know, benefited him, even though he wasn't in the world of education when he really got going.
Right.
So he graduates from LSU in agriculture education. He starts teaching at a high school.
Right.
And he figures out in about 3 months' time that teaching's not easy.
Not at the high school level.
Yeah, not at the high school level. And so he figured, this ain't for me. He lasted about 3 months, and he went to work for the state of Louisiana at what's known as the Louisiana Farm Bureau.
Yeah, and that's – Louisiana has, of course, our number one industry is oil and gas. Then you have – and it's kind of a toss-up between the two, but then you have seafood, and then it's agriculture.
Right? Yeah.
And the seafood and agriculture are kind of on the same level. In like where I'm from, it's all farms or we raise trees.
Yeah.
And so agriculture, y'all, is beyond just raising cows. It's, you know, growing trees. It's everything that you can profit from in the long run by growing it or raising it.
That's right. And he was kind of a master of that, having grown up in it and then got official education in it. And in 1976,
I was 6 years old.
I was two.
Yeah, right.
In 1976, he finally starts his career in state government. Yeah. And he started out with the Louisiana Department of Corrections as the Assistant Secretary for Agribusiness.
And that's huge. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, and this is just a straight up truth, and it's how I got my state government job, my first one with the Department of Corrections. Actually, when I was in high school, I got a job. One of the local state reps got me a job cutting grass at the old folks' home, the state run old folks' home,
yeah,
and the villa. So when he gets this job with the state, there's a lot of things that go along with that. And one of them is, and that I have some personal knowledge about this, I'll tell y'all probably on the next episode. One of them is you're civil service.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of protections afforded to you through the civil service, and you get your guaranteed raises. You're never going to get rich, but you have a protection. There's a certain comfort level of that. And
yeah, they can't just fire you.
Right. No. So, well, real quick. They said, when I left the sheriff's office to go to state police, they were like, why would you? No, when I left the university PD, we were civil service, to go to the sheriff's office. And they were like, why would you leave a civil service job to go somewhere where you're an at-will employee? I said, well, I don't need civil service to save my job.
Right.
Right. But civil service, and this is the truth, this is how much protection you have. If I was state police and I walked into my captain's office and I got on his desk and I took a shit on his desk. The first time, all they can do is give you a verbal warning. The second time, I go in and I take a shit on his desk, then they can write you up for it. And the third time, they can fire you.
Wow.
There's only certain offenses like, you know, drugs or whatever that they can fire you for on the spot.
Did you ever take a shit on his desk?
No, I didn't. I didn't have a captain either. I answered to the colonel. But just an example, and they say it's like the Snark missile. And for you who don't remember, during the Iraq War, Saddam had these missiles called Snarks, and the every time they, you know, there was developed them, every time they fire them, the fuckers blow up, right?
Yeah.
And so they said civil service employee is like a Snark missile. You can't fire it and you can't make it work. But that's not true. A lot of the best people in the world are lifetime state employees, and a lot of my dear friends are.
Absolutely. And look, y'all, this is 1976. So the economy is down at this point in time. That was a really good job. And of course, look, any sort of state job at that level, sometimes you got to know somebody.
That's absolutely true.
That ain't changed. That's been that way since the beginning of time.
It is, and it's Louisiana.
That's right.
I got my job at the Department of Corrections because my dad pulled some strings with politicians.
Sure. I mean, and that was a good job, and this was a downtime in the economy. So Burrell freely admits, and he said this on many interviews, that his brother was instrumental in getting him that job. His brother, y'all, whether you're aware of this or not, was a senator from the state of Louisiana.
They look almost identical.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm surprised that they're not twins.
Yeah. So he starts that job, and y'all, he's a rock star at it. He's doing great. And in 1981, he gets an opportunity.
10 years before I went there.
Yeah.
In 1981, he became the warden of Dixon Correctional Institute, known as DCI, and he was only 38.
Only 38.
So warden when I met him,
prison.
When I met him, it was in 90 or 91, and of course he had been the warden for 10 years. DCI, y'all, is it's a mixed security prison, and this is kind of a misnomer here too, but mixed security meaning it has medium, maximum, and some trustee camps. The trustee camps would be like so Jackson, Louisiana is full of state-run facilities. The villa, like I was telling you about, the geriatric home, state-run. The hospital for the mentally insane, which is basically on DCI property right across the street from their cow barn, and it has the mental hospital, the state-run mental hospital. If you don't have health care and you legitimately to be, I'd say crazy. What's the politically correct term?
Nuts.
You're literally nuts. You went there, and I had an aunt who spent most of her life in that hospital. But then you have DCI. It's all these state run. The War Vets Home is there. The biggest state War Vets Home is there. So you have all these state run facilities, and I guarantee you, all my people from Jackson, I've got family from there. All of them were state employees at one facility or another. So DCI is located right outside of Jackson, y'all. And which is about 40 minutes north of Baton Rouge, a small town still to this day, one major road running through it. And then DCI is off of one of those roads. But the mixed security, the main camp at DCI where I worked, that you have the two maximum security camps. And then they had like the satellite, the trustee camp at the state mental hospital. And that's because they took care of everything there. They were orderlies and took care of the grounds and the whole nine yards. And I used to go to football practice, little peewee football practice on the state grounds.
Oh, come on.
There, and the prisoners would line up on the fence, all the trustees. And years later, on extra duty shifts, I would go pick up and I'd go be the guard at the trustee camp there.
Yeah.
But they do that for economic reasons. And Burrell had them do that for economic reasons because they didn't have to bust them back and forth to work every day.
Wow.
And so they were there around the clock. And they were instrumental in all the state-run facilities. The
100%. Trustees,
the cow barns and everything I'm talking about. Look, DCI wasn't 18,000 acres, but it was a lot.
Yeah.
But spread out in different areas. And in the cow barns and all that shit, they raise cattle.
Yeah.
And for the state of Louisiana. But anyway, it was there, Burl.
38 years old.
I didn't know that.
When I was 38, started, there's no way I'm running a prison. I'm lucky to stay out of prison.
Right. You're right. And I was a detective still when I was 38. But
yeah, really amazing and a huge opportunity. And guess what? It was his first experience as being a warden, what he would become just an absolute legend for. At that time, DCI had about 1,400 inmates. That was its capacity, and it was female and male,
right?
Which made it different from other prisons. It was also relatively new. It had been built in 1976.
Right.
So it was only 6 years old.
Right.
That's like the, you know, state of the art
right.
prisons, especially compared to Angola right. at that time, which right. was 100 years old.
By the time
old.
I got there in 91, there were no females there. It was probably like 2,500 they had added on to it.
Yeah. So no females at that time. Gotcha.
And then the other kicker is, and I forgot to mention this earlier, so I say it's about 40 minutes north of Baton Rouge. Well, guess what? It's only 30 miles from Bloody Angola.
And so it's
East and West Feliciana. I was born and raised in Clinton where my grandfather was a judge, but West Feliciana butts up to it. And my mama was from West Feliciana where her daddy was the DA during this time, actually. But when that 30 miles is deceiving, because back then they had the old road to Bloody Angola, and that wound up the Tunica Hills, and part of it was gravel and shit. And it took, when you turned off of 61, it took you another 40 minutes to get from there, that last 10 miles to get to Angola.
Oh, it seemed like 300 miles. Right. Yeah, it was not what you would call picturesque. You're not looking at the Rockies when you're going down the highway. So, this is where Kane coined one of his, what would eventually be one of his most famous phrases. He started at the facility, and as is common, your first day on the job as warden, you're going to have a meeting with right. all of your people, and you're going to learn the ins and outs of this prison, things that maybe the outgoing warden didn't tell you. And right. one of the things he found out was that they had no worship services for the inmates, and it was where he kind of coined the phrase moral rehabilitation.
And he carried that.
All
we'll
today.
Talk about it, but he still carries to this day. Yeah. And he was serious about it.
Yeah. And it was one of the first things he changed at Dixon.
Right.
Was bringing religion into prisons.
Right.
Something that we're going to talk a lot about. So he becomes a rock star again. He's just killing it at Dixon.
And let me tell you just a couple real quick stories. And I know I'm going off script, but I met him the first time, and I think it was 1990 or 91, and I got hired. So he had what they call the White House, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the White House was the administrative building. I had to go to the White House to do paperwork and stuff like that. I hadn't seen him. And then they put me on the largest rec room after I got back from Angola doing my training and all that. They put me on the largest rec room at DCI.
Yeah.
And I ended up, long story short, I ended up getting in a fight with an inmate because the captain told me, you give them direct verbal orders like, hey, do this. And if they don't do it, you can arrest them for it.
Yeah.
And so one of them I told to come with me, and he turned around and ran out in the yard, and I had to hit my pager and get the captain to come, and the captain went out there and got him and arrested him. He said, but next time you do it, you hit your pager and you use whatever force necessary to bring the situation under control. Well, it wasn't 2 weeks later, Sunday night, they turned off the lights in the dorm, and I told them to clear the rec room except for the night guys that were up, and one guy was standing on the back wall and by the water fountain with his foot up on the wall, and we say, catch your house. And I told him, I said, catch your house. And he just kind of looked at me. I said, I'm not going to tell you again, catch your house. And he didn't move. And so I hit my pager, and I said, well, you're under arrest. You're coming with me. He said, fuck you. And he turned around and walked into the dorm, which was closing down at that time, and the lights and the inmates are shuffling back and forth, getting the water, going to the bathroom, and I tackled him, and the fist fight was on. So Captain Raymond Newman said, he said, man, when I hit that rec room door, and I was a long ways away from it, he said, and I didn't see you. He said, I knew sugar had turned to shit. He said, I knew shit was going down, and what happened was that there's a couple fireable offenses. One, if you get caught having sex with an inmate, or you get caught bringing in contraband, and or sleeping on duty, civil service doesn't protect you for that. I mean, the biggest one is if another officer is in a fight and you don't help them, then you can be fired on the spot. Well, there's two sergeants on the dorm. I'm fighting with this guy. I didn't think I could start a riot. Right?
Right.
And I'm fighting with this guy, and he's a big dude. And one of the desk sergeants trying to help me. The other one was like froze up, didn't want to do anything. Newman came in, long story short, we get him out. And I mean, we were punching. We were throwing, punches in my eye. I was swollen and stuff. And long story short, Ray gets me to the office. He said, Ray, you got to go home. I'm like, fuck, I'm getting fired, man. I said, bro, you told me use whatever force necessary. And I said that he wouldn't stop and put my hands on him, and he went to fight. And he said, yeah, but he said, you could have started a fucking riot, man. And he said, you realize that? He said, you got to go home and we'll call you. I'm like, fuck, I'm getting fired. And so they called me on Monday morning, and he said, you need to report to Warden Kane's office.
Oh, shit.
And I'm like, my first time in the life on the carpet besides the military, right? Being on, called on the carpet means you know you're going to get your ass chewed or get fired or whatever. And he brought me in, and I'll never forget him. He actually got up from behind his desk and he shook my hand.
Yeah.
And he said, Sergeant Over, come on in. And he said, have a seat. He said, boy, tell me what happened. I said, Warden Kane, you know, Captain Newman, and then he was in there. I wasn't trying to throw him on the bus. I said, this is what happened before. He told me next time, use whatever force necessary to bring the situation under control. And so I did. And I said, we ended up fighting. He said, kind of leaned back and steepled his fingers a little bit, kind of like Carney Foster would. And Warden Kane, he's not big in stature. He's not tall, but he's not fat. But he's kind of I don't want to say heavy set, but he's kind of more of a roundish shape. You wouldn't, you know, think this guy has such a presence.
Right.
But he does. But he was just super, super nice. And he said, all right. He said, all right, son, I get that. And he said, I appreciate you taking the initiative. He said, but I'm going to send you somewhere where you could fight every single night. And he said, I said, well, where's that? He said, I'm going to send you to the working cell block. And he said, that's where that we have our worst of our worst, and somebody's going to be an act. He'd say, you know what? He would curse sometimes, say, as religious as he was, and he probably did say ass. When he got mad, he'd curse, but he said, I'm going to send you back there. And believe me, and this, I passed this down to all the guys I trained over the years. I would tell them, I say, look, you don't have to go out of your way, put your hands on somebody to look for shit, because there's enough assholes out there that are legitimately going to give you a reason to fight them,
right? Yeah.
When you go to arrest them or whatever. And he said, I'm going to put you back there. And I did it. And I rose up and was a superstar. And every time he'd see me, he'd say, how you doing, Sergeant Overton? And
love that story. And I'm sure you've got several. And what we're going to do, folks, is this is going to be a docuseries. So this is going to be three episodes. In the third episode, we're going to have Kelly Jennings, who also has some experience with Burl Kane on the show, and it's going to be storytelling time with Woody and Kelly.
Right, right. There you go.
And they're going to tell some stories that are just fire.
We need to promote that.
Yeah.
The last episode is going to be the true stories.
The true stories.
From Woody.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You can't get no better than that. And look, right. I got the best seat in the house, and I'm going to be kind of the moderator of what will be an amazing episode coming up just in a couple of weeks. So we're going to move on, and look, Warden Kane, he became an absolute star. He made a name for himself, and of course, he had a brother that was in politics, right. And so they knew the Kane name, and in 1995, the Warden of Angola, a guy by the name of John Whitley, who at some point we're going to do a story on,
right.
But John Whitley was retiring, and So secretary at that time was Richard Stadler.
Stadler. And he was the head of the Department of Corrections when I was there also.
So that secretary, he is kind of like who is the boss of the wardens.
He's the boss of all the prisons.
Yeah. So he is the top of the outside of the governor. He right. is the top person
right.
in the prison system. And he announces the new warden will be the warden at that time of DCI, which was Burrell Kane. Now, you may be surprised to know something. Burrell Kane did not want that job.
Right. Well, and that's because he knew that wardens in Angola didn't last long.
That's right.
I think they averaged just over 5 years of service, because Angola was so bad, y'all, and somebody had to be the scapegoat for the bad things that happened. But, but he wasn't left much of a choice doing him. He had the most experience of any warden in the state of Louisiana with his 14 years at DCI. And so, I mean, he took it.
Yeah.
And
Secretary Stadler just basically said, you're going to be the warden of Angola. Right.
And when he took it, I tell you that it was truly bloody Angola, and they were under all this federal scrutiny and everything else. And he's like, don't want to do it. I'm sure it was a challenge to him, but he didn't want to lose what he had going on.
No, you're 14 years at one place. You right. have a system.
Right.
It's working.
Right.
You're looked at as a rock star in the system, and now you're being sent another challenge. You're comfortable. You don't want to have to do that. But also, Angola had some issues. There were 300 attacks on the staff.
Yeah.
And 766 inmate-on-inmate assaults, half of which were women.
That was in 1 year.
Yeah.
The year before he went there. And this was right around when I was getting out of corrections. He left right after I left DCI. And it went up there, but fuck, I knew about it. I mean, you heard about it, it didn't make the news every day, but it made the correction officer grapevine. All right, it was bad shit.
Yeah. Yeah, and it was. I remember when he was announced as the warden of Angola, and if you were from the state of Louisiana, I mean, that was big news.
Right. Yeah.
Big news, yeah. and so he, a side note to that, and this may not seem out of order, but I'm going to mention it now. He was actually still living at DCI throughout. Wardens typically live at the prison they're at.
Right. They have very nice homes that are provided to them by the state at no cost. It's part of your salary.
Yeah.
Right? And it's maintained by the convicts and all that. Well, he took the job. But shit, nobody wants to move to, especially back then, wanted to move to Angola, not even on the beeline, because it's so fucking far away.
Right.
And I knew his wife at the time, and he was there, and he's got kids and the whole nine yards.
Well, and you may wonder who took his place at DCI. Well, Jimmy LeBlanc took his place there. They were good friends.
Jimmy was an underwarden to Burrell at the time. And so basically, Burrell Kane tapped him to take it over.
Right. And he made a deal with him. He said, look, you take it over. I think you would be a great replacement for me, but I ain't moving out my house.
Yeah, right.
He literally said that, and Jimmy LeBlanc was okay with that. And in the state of Louisiana, they gave Jimmy LeBlanc kind of a stipend for the home he was already living in, because that's considered a perk.
It is. It's a huge part of your salary.
Yeah.
It's a big part of your salary. I'm sure you have it in here, Jim, that when Stadler retired, Jimmy LeBlanc ultimately became
the head of the Department of Corrections. We'll be getting into that. But Kane, just to finish that point up, Kane lived at DCI, y'all, until 1999. And what prompted him to actually leave
4 years,
was the murder of Captain David Knapps in Angola. And we'll get into that in the second episode. Yes.
Captain David Knapps was a multi-generational correctional officer, and he lived on the beeline, and that's all he ever knew, his father done.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
His grandfather done his brothers and everybody, you know, he lived there and he was brutally murdered in 99 during a attempted prison escape.
And
we're gonna cover that.
Yeah.
And, he's a superhero, but Burl would have been his boss for almost 5 years at that time.
Yeah.
And so. The one thing I'm gonna tell you about Burl King is any good leader in any good spot, if your people take care of you, you're damn well going to take care of your people. And you're going to know who they are. And you're going to promote them up and everything. Because unfortunately, and I've said this many times, that, and I felt this, I truly did believe this, there were some of the people that you worked with in corrections were shittier than the convicts.
Yeah.
And I think that plays into the whole civil service thing because you can't fire them, you can't make them work, and they knew the rule books and all that. But absolutely, 95% of them were the best people in the world. But Burl knew who were his rising stars and who would run whatever. And David Nafs was one of them.
Look, being a good leader, one of the best attributes you can have is being able to spot other good leaders.
But Burl might have been and I've had so many, and I'm telling you, I think he is probably one of the best leaders I've ever had. And I'm talking about my military career, my police career, my corrections career, whatever. Yeah,
you've been around a lot of them.
He absolutely, and I took a lot of his leadership skills from him, and he absolutely, like that day when I was trouble in his office, I mean, if I'd have been a turd, he'd have fired me.
Yeah.
Right. And, but no, he gave me freedom to run. Right. And he knew I was going to handle my business.
Yeah. So imagine, you know, you're Burl King. It's 1995, February, and you're now in charge of the largest maximum security prison in America, 18,000 acres of sheer intimidation.
And the worst of the worst.
And the worst of the worst.
I would put those guys up there against any convict in the world as far as the horrificness of the crimes, et cetera.
So Warden gets there, and one of the first things he did was he outlines his philosophy to the inmates. And I'm going to quote him here. He said, "Your dorm is like a city or a community. The beds and houses along that are the street, with the street being the aisle itself. So three beds down is like saying three houses down. You should visit your neighbors.
I actually say that, yeah.
Counsel your neighbors and be concerned for each other. Keep your city free from drugs and violence, and don't curse."
Right.
"Once you start cursing each other, violence is sure to follow." That was his absolute philosophy.
Genius. Absolute genius. And do you know that to this day, that's what they call their bunks and stuff is their houses?
Yeah.
And aisles, because it's these big, long aisles, y'all, that run in between rows of bunks, and they call them their streets.
That's their streets.
Isn't that crazy?
It is.
I never knew Burl was the one that coined that phrase.
Yeah. And so I'm going to tell you a quick story here. Woody and I both, and this is about, you know, when he went to Angola, he had to deal with one thing he didn't have to really deal with at DCI, and that was executions.
Yep.
I don't care who you are. I don't care how blessed you are to deal with certain things. That's hard for anybody.
Right. And keeping in mind that Burl is still had it. I mean, when I knew him, and as far as I know to this day, he's a very strong Christian man.
Absolutely. So his first experience with that was with an inmate by the name of Thomas Ward. And this would play probably, I bet if Burl was sitting across from us and Warden Kane, if you'd ever like to sit across from absolutely. Us, we'd love to have you. I've tried to reach out to your guy. Yeah. But if he was sitting across from us, he'd probably say this changed him more than anything else he's ever done. So it was just after midnight. Warden Kane found himself alone. He was in the death chamber with Thomas Ward. And without one word, Woody, he lifts his hand. He gives a thumbs down signal, which he would later say he hated. He hated doing that. It did not feel right to him. But it was a signal that was common to give to the executioner when you would – this was lethal injection. So when you would issue that lethal dose, he would give that thumbs down signal. The lethal dose gets administered, and 6 minutes later, Ward was dead. It was Kane's first execution. Now, immediately, Kane began to regret that signal, as I told you. His uneasiness, it started to grow. He felt guilty because he never – found out Ward's spiritual condition that night or before.
Right.
He just basically ordered, you know, the lethal dose to be administered. Warden Kane actually was quoted as saying he didn't utter a word as we strapped him to the gurney. When the time came to ask him if he had anything to say, he didn't answer. He just choked up. The execution took place only 3 months, y'all, after Kane took over as warden and completely spearheaded the change that we're about to tell you in that prison.
Right. So real quick, let's go back to that. So, you know, we've talked about executions before on the show, but now in the execution chamber, the warden is the one that's in there, and they have to, you know, read the death warrant. But given that thumbs down, you know, he didn't know what he was going to feel. It's the first time he ever basically legally murdered someone. And that's it. But I know as a Christian man, he just saw somebody be murdered, even though it's legal murder.
Yeah.
They just saw the state of Louisiana take a human being's life, and he knows that he's not in there for being a choir boy. But as a Christian, he's thinking, you know what? I should have talked to him. Even if he did, told me, go to hell, I don't believe in Jesus, I would have done my job as a Christian to try to spread the word, to give him a chance to call on Jesus to repent.
That's right. And, you know, he had a conversation with his mother, Woody, after this. It bothered him that much.
Right.
And his mom said, you need to do everything you can to get those guys spiritually ready to meet the Lord, because you're going to have to answer that.
Because God gives me...
Yeah, me too.
When you have that opportunity, and so very few people do ever have an opportunity to talk to someone that you know is about to die.
Yeah.
And even like I said, even if they reject you, if you don't take that opportunity, you have to answer for it.
You're going to have to answer for it. And it bothered him. So he literally, this is the start, y'all, and we can't tell you how – we can't even dictate into words how huge this is, but this was the start of a change at Angola, like – and not to sound like Donald Trump, but like nothing you've ever seen. You know, just unbelievable. He started instituting what he called, and this was another phrase that he coined, cultural change.
Yep.
The first thing he did, and thank God Woody was not working there at this time.
I've damn sure been in trouble for it.
He banned cursing by guards and inmates. Now, you can only control that so much, but it was definitely frowned upon. I think that's why he banned he believed.
They put it in the rule book after that, you can't curse.
Yeah, and he believed that cursing led to other things. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the curse word itself. Mm-hmm. Now, it's what he said. He said one every now and then, but it was when it was appropriate.
I said a fucking lie.
What
he's talking about, and I got to interject again.
Sure.
What he's talking about is, but I would carry this later on. And when I talk to the younger guys and say, listen, you most of the time when you're dealing with people, you're dealing with them on their worst day. They're going to be upset. They're going to be screaming. They're going to be cursing. I said, you should start out nice as can be. When I was on the street, unless we were fighting or something, we didn't curse people. Willie Graves would have hung your ass or any department I worked for. I said, you always start out low and treat them super kind. Even if they're cursing you and berating you, start out low, because then if you need to jump up and escalate, they'll be surprised.
Yeah. Right?
But just, I mean – one person cursing at another one, it's not going to end well usually.
That's
it's going
right.
to end, especially between men, and one of them has never had any respect for authority in their entire life, and they hate you as a correctional officer. So what is it doing with this just simple thing by taking out curse words or trying to take out curse words? He is making a mutual level of respect. So you take that off, that gasoline that can do no good,
yeah.
right? And somebody's going to feel degraded. Somebody's going to be pissed off. I say, fuck you, Jim Chapman. You're a dick.
Yeah.
Right? Where's it going from there?
That's right.
Yeah, but I say,
fist to cuff.
If you tell me to do, you know, give me a direct verbal order, and I'm like, oh, yes, sir. Then,
yeah.
Right? Then yeah. I can go write you up. There's other ways to handle it. So that was genius on Brawl's part.
It really was. And, you know, he also instituted cleanliness.
Yes.
And like we told you earlier, that you know, he had this conversation with the inmates where he said, this is your house.
Right.
Keep your house clean. Right. You know, encourage your neighbors to keep their house clean.
And most of them come from lifestyles that they never had anything clean. They yeah. lived in the hoods. They were raised around cursing. They had no respect for anything. And yeah. he's just trying to give them the base things of be, I mean, just because you're in prison, it doesn't mean you're not living.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right. And he started inviting kind of the outside world. Look, let me tell y'all real quick. One of the hardest things to do for me in preparation for these shows is research. And why is that? Because we're dealing with a prison where not a lot gets out.
Right.
For obvious reasons, right. and I get it.
Right.
But it requires an enormous amount of work to dig up some of this stuff
right.
because it just doesn't get out. He, at the beginning, was very open with inviting people into the prison, mm-hmm. letting them see. Look, Barbara Walters, which we'll tell you a story on later, right. Came into the prison and actually did I think it was a 2020 special on the executions that take place there. So it was a huge thing on that front. But his message initially was, we don't have anything to hide, and we want to let people in here see what we're doing to change
right.
what is
not that we're
in a perfect. Horrible situation.
Yeah, not that we're perfect by far, but we're not hiding anything.
Right. Well,
the culture in the past was, shit, you know, loose lips sink ships. It happens in Angola, it dies in Angola.
So I know y'all are ready for something here, and that is, what was one of the more historic changes that he made right off the bat? Well, we got it for you. One of the first, maybe one of the most controversial changes that he made, but this is Burl Cain genius right here.
Right.
So he's sitting at, I'm assuming he's sitting at his desk one morning, this is how I'm picturing it, and he says, we got a problem. Our death row inmates, most of them can't read and they can't write.
That's right.
It might surprise y'all to know that they didn't offer any sort of education, even as simple as reading and writing to death row inmates.
No, they just locked them up.
Yeah. So you might say to yourself, well, who cares? Burl Cain cared. And the reason he cared was not, these are condemned men.
Right.
So they're probably not getting out. Although we have done many stories with you guys where people were exonerated and didn't do it. Right. So there are those situations. But his thing was, if they can't read and they can't write, especially if they can't read, they can't read the Bible.
Right.
That was a problem for him. He didn't like that.
That's exactly right.
And so it was the first change he made was he said, we're going to offer education to our death row inmates.
Right.
That's huge. What do you ever
do? That's huge. And those, but like you said, most of them had never had any kind of education, right?
Right.
So what do you give? And ultimately, y'all, during this time, the death penalty put on hold and stuff like that, years later and stuff. But what do you give somebody who's locked up 23 hours a day and then they're out by themselves?
Yeah.
I mean, that's where people go crazy. And I mean, they got nothing to do. They didn't have TVs, they didn't have all this stuff, and so he gives them, we say the word hope, not hope that they're going to live, but he gives them something to do besides sit there and rot.
That's right.
And if you're going to sit there and rot, maybe if the Bible's the only book you can read, maybe you glean something from it, and it goes back to what his mama said. You got to give him the opportunity.
You got to give him the opportunity, and that's just what he did. It was controversial. Look, there were people screaming, why are we spending money to educate, you know, death row inmates? And yes, most of them did horrible things. But his thought process was, I'm not only in charge of their, you know, the way he felt about it, I'm not only in charge of their imprisonment, I'm in charge of their soul. Right. And this is between me and God and what I am doing to try to help these men. And that's the way he thought. And the prisoners themselves really started to take note. This guy seems like he cares.
Right, right.
I mean, it was probably an absolute shock to them.
Right. He didn't judge them for what, and I got this from his time too. And he told me this, he said, your job is not to punish them. Your job is to keep them safe and keep the public safe from them escaping, et cetera.
Yeah.
Right? They're doing their time for their crime. Your job is not to punish them. You treat them like a human being. And that nobody had ever done that.
Nobody had ever done that. And so he does another historical thing right after that, and that is he was the first warden to invite, and in this case it was the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary, to come in. And basically they had like a satellite seminary right there at Angola. For those of you that don't know what they do, they offer degrees in the field of seminary.
Right.
So you can become an ordained minister.
Basically it's like a Bible college.
Yeah.
Right.
This was genius.
Right.
I cannot stress enough how genius this was, because in his long-term vision, and if anybody can say anything about Burl Cain, he had vision.
Right. Right.
In his long-term vision, he saw inmates changing other inmates through God.
Right.
And that's what was missing in prisons, in his opinion. That was probably, looking back on it, one of the most successful programs he ever had. Those graduates, they would be allowed to travel not only to other prisons in Louisiana, but eventually all over the country. They were going all over the country speaking to these other prisons. And he called that imposing morality.
Right. And back to it, y'all, now you get a degree from a college, then you have a little bit more self-worth, right? And
yes.
these college studies aren't free. They were funded by outside donations, and Angola offered a four-year college degree in ministry, including instructions in Greek and Hebrew, as well as lessons on how to preach.
Yeah, and you know, it really changed the lives of not only these inmates themselves,
yeah,
and gave them self-worth, but it enabled them to go out and then work to change others.
Right. And if you're doing that, and then this gives you the bumps again, if you're doing that and you get self-worth for the first time in your life, guess what you're not doing? You're not raping and killing.
Yep.
Inside the prison.
That's
they
right.
were still raping and killing. And
let me tell you hit something. It right on the head.
Look, we're going to talk about the Christianity and God and all this stuff a lot during this series. But here's the deal. I don't care what you believe in, but there certainly are convicts at Angola that were like, fuck you, I don't believe in anything, I'm an atheist, whatever. And that's fine too. But they were given the opportunity because Burl was raised that way.
That's right. And he knew that the principles in religion
right.
were – sound things that would keep people out of trouble.
He also knew Angola was full of the darkness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to shine a little light and make the darkness back up.
That's right. So he started thinking about this and looking at the things that were missing from Angola. This became pretty successful. And he knew that work was, or learning to work,
right,
was critical in rehabilitation. Many of the inmates in Angola, y'all, they had never learned to work. They basically grew up in life. They robbed, they raped, they pillaged, and they murdered to survive. So he instilled what he called meaningful work.
Well, yeah, and let me tell you this, another famous Burl Cain saying, when you get to prison, He introduced himself and he said, "Welcome to the Department of Corrections. You're here for however long you've been sentenced." He said, "And we're not here to punish you. We're here to make you secure." He said, "But you're sentenced to at hard labor." He said, "Religion is an option. You'll have the opportunity while you're here to get religion." He said, "But work is not. You're going to work every day, and everybody has a job." And that goes back to him teaching the basics. Like I said, most of them never even knew how to work. They weren't raised like my daddy raised me and your daddy raised you, and with the good work ethic.
That's right. And so it also gave them that pride that they were seeking, obviously teaching these inmates to work. And he wasn't done yet. And this is probably, it definitely is another part of his vision in those early days. And that was he founded a program in Angola called Malachi Dads. Right. He did this with some inmates who came to him. And now Warden Kane, he took note, y'all, of the fact that almost all convicts on Angola grew up in a broken home with the father typically being absent. That's at any prison in the country. Right. Overall, it is not even close.
It's not something we're making up.
It's an issue. Not
people we're picking on or whatever. It's just the way it is.
Yeah. I mean, you're talking 6,000 inmates, and most of them were fathers, but they came from broken homes. And so it didn't take a genius for Warden Kane to figure out maybe that's part of the problem. Now, you can't fix the people that are in there. They can't be at home with their kids, right? They're in prison. But this program,
in prison for the worst.
The worst of the worst. Yeah. So he knew that there's kids out there, and they're now growing up without a father because he's in prison.
Also, I'm going to interrupt you again. There are generational prisoners in there. There are fathers and whose sons are grandfathers, who are dads whose sons murdered and grew up because it's the only thing they ever knew, right? And they got sent to Angola, and I'm telling you, there's generational. Their grandson, the oldest one now, who's an old timer to Angola, whose son is down now for life for murder. That guy's son would come in for murder.
Yeah,
I mean, he's looking at this and he's like,
"It's a pattern."
It's proven, right? And you're right. Him being a forward genius thinker, he's like, you know what? Why wouldn't I try this?
Yeah,
why wouldn't I try? If I could make a change in one person's life, it'd be something special. And nobody had ever done what you're about to tell him about.
That's right. So he gets with about let's say these six trusted inmates that he had that were all graduates of the seminary. Mm-hmm. And he says, "Do y'all see the same problem I do?" And they said, "Not only do we see the problem, we can institute a program where we teach other inmates how to be fathers behind bars."
Right.
It's possible, right?
Right.
So they form, and look, I got chill bumps again.
Yes,
they form what they call Malachi Dads, and basically this is one of the best programs he ever instituted, and it was a program in which fathers that were incarcerated learned how to parent their kids from inside of prison. We're going to play you a clip real quick, and this is the founder, these are the inmate founders of Malachi Dads, and they're discussing a little bit about Warden Kane and a lot about that program. We're going to play that right now.
My name is Ron Hicks, and I've been incarcerated 25 years. I'm serving life sentence for second-degree murder.
My name is Darrell Waters. I'm from Gibson, Louisiana, and I was sentenced to second-degree murder in 1992.
My name is George Gillum. I am from New Orleans. I'm currently serving a life sentence for a second-degree murder. We discovered in 2006 that a child of an incarcerated father had a 70% likelihood to come to prison. And so we discovered those statistics, and God gave us favor, and that became Malachi Dads. Just because you're locked up in prison, that does not give you the right to not still be a father. Healthy people who have a heart that's healed, who have a soul that's whole, they want to help, they want to give back, and that's what we do every day.
Why do you think violence has come down in Angola.
When Warren came on the scene, what he did was open up the door of opportunity. He was able to see, if I can get these guys to start coming after success, because what success do, it changed the way you think. If I can achieve something, I feel better about myself.
Wow, super. There's so much to be said, y'all. I'm going to do one more part that is maybe, I don't want to say it shows a harsher side, because it's not a harsher side, but it shows business side of Burl.
Now, he's, a good
all,
story.
He's all about trying to shine the light in the darkness and see how, what kind of positive things can come about it. But he's also all about, it was his prison and he's going to rule it, right?
Yeah.
But listen to this story. This is crazy. And Jim researched this, and I had never, believe it or not, I'd never even heard of this. But as we've told you many times on the show, Angola is huge, right? It's sprawling over 18,000 acres. And that's mostly, the camps are spread out. It's mostly agriculture. Big fields, Tunica Hills, Mississippi River. So there's a lot, shit ton of wildlife, right? So one day, one of the convicts saw a huge 400-pound black bear on the property, right? And they freaked out. And they're like, holy shit. Most of these guys are city boys, et cetera.
Yeah. They don't like the wolf dogs.
Right. And it until 2 years ago, I had never seen a bear in the state of Louisiana. But in Jackson, where DCI was, the first restaurant I worked at was called Bear Corners. Back in the day, black bears were prevalent in the area. And now they're coming back because strict hunt ban, et cetera. But you got this massive 18,000 acres, and as rare as they are, there's a bear.
Yeah.
In the middle of the prison.
Right.
Massive black bear living in the middle of Angola. And you know what Burl thought?
I can only
imagine. What? Kind of scared me. And I know it scared them because they came running to me. And he's like, that's just extra security.
Right? That's exactly how he thinks.
He said, and I'll quote him, he said, I love that bear being right where it is. And I tell you what, none of our inmates are going to try to get out after dark and wander around when they might run into a big old bear. It's like having another guard at no cost to the taxpayer. He was about business. We keep talking about all these good things that he's doing. Let me tell you something. I've seen it, and we'll talk about it in later episodes in the series. I've seen it. That's one dude you don't want to see mad. And it's one dude that knows his business, right?
That's right.
Because anyway, the bear was first seen by an inmate crossing the road in the prison, and it was taking a stroll near the center of the prison, where about 5.5 square miles is mostly untouched piney woods, y'all. And the prison workers measured the bear's footprints, which were 6 inches in diameter. Now, every inch that thing can measure equals 75 pounds.
Wow.
The biologists have figured this out. So that made that bear about 450 pounds. And Kane said, the wildlife people told us they think it's a big female they've been tracking for a while. And Warren Kane estimated at the time that 8 to 10 bears lived on that 18,000 acres.
Holy crap.
And you better believe he promoted the shit out of
that. Oh, yeah. I was about to say that. He told every inmate. Yeah.
And when they come in, hey, and if you're out in the field, you see a bear, you ain't going to be the fast. You just got to be fast from one of the other convicts. Now, we might not shoot you if you're running from the bear, but if you go out there at night, that bear's hungry.
Yeah.
Bear's got to eat, right? So,
y'all, we're just getting started.
Yeah, just getting started.
But we got to cut this one off. We've gone over an hour.
Still, I'm going to say it again. Wait until you hear. I mean, we talked a lot about the positive side today, which is something. But I'm going to tell you something. Tough dude, bro. There's a reason he lasted as long as he lasted and is still doing what he does. But it's the totality of circumstances of the man, which to me makes him a legend.
Yeah, and we're going to give you just to give you a little a little sauce for what you can look forward to the next episode. We're going to talk about a little bit about Billy Cannon and his how Burl Kane was instrumental in bringing him to Angola. We're going to talk about Hurricane Katrina and the effect that that had on Angola prison. Y'all are going to love that story. Look, these are stuff you cannot find anywhere else.
And we're going to talk about some executions. And
yeah, and how about his second execution than the first, right?
And then what would I mean? Yeah, what happened following after that? And just a whole
Captain
lot.
Knapps,
Captain David Knapps,
a bunch more to bring you.
And can't wait to bring in. And we appreciate love each and every one of y'all. And
yeah, thank y'all for
Patreon members.
Everything
you rock, right? Our Patreon members, the show couldn't run without you. We appreciate y'all so much. Y'all, look, if you want to be a Patreon member, go to patreon.com/bloodyangola. And
we've got a bonus episode coming next week.
Right.
So what we're going to do next week when we record our second episode of the story of Burl Kane, we're also going to record our bonus episode just for patron members. Right. And what it's going to be on, y'all, is we told y'all, you know, we released the first episode to the general public, but it was on executions. And we kind of told a little bit of the story, and it was great. We've got more for you, but it's only going to be for patrons, that second one. And so go join it.
And y'all, we have all the different tier levels with all the different benefits. And I'm telling you right now, I've been doing this over 5 years podcasting, and my real life, real crime original probably doesn't have as many patron episodes locked up as
we got a ton of
Bloody Angola.
That's
so
right.
If you like Bloody Angola, go subscribe. If you can't be a patron member, we love you just as much.
In transcripts. People love the transcripts. We've got all of our episodes transcribed on Patreon for some of the tiers. And these are not transcriptions, y'all, that are like the AI versions.
Right.
This is actually someone sitting down typing. Because, you know, our Southern accents don't cross over well.
Right. I can imagine what the words would say.
It's horrible. Right. Yeah.
And look, we have merchandise.
Yeah.
People love the shirts and the
hats.
And what about the Bloody Angola wine?
Oh, yeah. Got a little bit of wine in there for you ladies.
And that's good stuff.
Yeah.
And I mean, we sold out of it at the live show. So,
yeah.
But anyway, y'all, please share us and
review
like us and leave us a review if you're so inclined. And we appreciate you and love you and wait until you hear what's coming next.
Oh, yeah. And until next time, I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
Your host of Bloody
Angola.
A podcast 142 years in the making.
The complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
Peace. Bam.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang, Rango the Three.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.